Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day and the Trailblazers, who had more to do with the civil rights movement than they often receive credit for. The roughly 1 million African American men and women who served in our armed forces, as segregated as they were during World War II. If you've ever visited Arlington National Cemetery, you might know that the grave of boxing legend Joe Louis is one of the most frequently visited memorials there. Louis served in the Special Services Division during World War II, eventually entertaining more than 2 million soldiers with nearly 100 wartime boxing exhibitions. Joe Louis became friends with Jackie Robinson, who of course served in the Army before breaking the color barrier in Major League Baseball. But longtime Hometown Heroes listeners know Jackie was not the first one invited to carry that mantle. Another World War II veteran, Monty Irvin, was. You might know the name. He's a Baseball Hall of Famer. Born in Alabama as one of 13 children in a family loaded with athletic talent, he grew up in New Jersey, and get this, while playing college football, he moonlighted as a professional baseball player in the Negro Leagues, playing only road games under the pseudonym Jimmy Nelson so he wouldn't be found out. Barnstorming tours with Major League stars made it clear that the players in his league could hold their own, but baseball's color barrier remained.
Well, we were disappointed, and we made some friends with some of the Major Leaguers, and we told them, we said, why don't you guys talk it up? You know, maybe we could help him win a pennant or a World Series. So they said, well, we'll do what we can, but you know how negative the owners are. I said, well, keep talking, because it's bound to happen one of these days. And sure enough, in 1946, Bob Feller, one of my dear friends, he formed an all-star team, and Satchel Paige formed an all-star team, and they played each other. They broke about even, but it showed everybody, you know, including the scouts, that we could play baseball as well as anybody. All we needed was a chance. And after that, the scouts out there looking for talent signed a lot of the African-American players.
Now, you at one point left the Negro Leagues and went to the Mexican League, won a triple crown there. But I understand, with all the great hitters that you could have looked at to model your game after, it wasn't someone in your league, but it was an Italiano wearing pinstripes that you modeled your swing after. Is that true?
That's true. Joe DiMaggio. I saw him when he broke in with the Yankees in 1936. I was hitting the ball well, but I wasn't hitting the ball a lot to right field. So I want to, you know, being a right-handed hitter, I wanted to pull the ball, so I used to go there and watch him, and he was a dead pull hitter, and how quick he was, you know, when he was getting the bat around with his follow through, and how graceful he looked at the plate and so on. So in 39, when I went to Daytona Beach for spring training, I practiced hitting the way he did, and by the time spring training was over, I had it. And from 39 on, I became a pretty good hitter, I tell you.
Well, yeah, 422 is pretty good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was tough to strike out. I was strong, you know, naturally strong. And all I needed to do was just get that bat around a little quicker. And with the Joe DiMaggio stance and the fact that, you know, you didn't stride very far, maybe 4 or 5 inches, you could judge the ball and see the ball and be in position to hit a curveball, changeup, or a fastball. So it didn't take me long to copy Joe. Later on, I told him about it. He said, "Well, I'm glad somebody thought enough of me to copy my style."
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked pretty well for you too.
And guess what? Willie Mays did the same thing.
Hey, there you go. Everyone seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Yep. Do you remember how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Standing on second base in Puerto Rico.
Really?
When they announced that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. And the people started to cheer. So I said to myself, I said, they don't know, you know, what a big problem that's going to be, because everything that came into Puerto Rico came in on a ship.
Mm.
You know, the rice and the beans and everything else. And then 3 weeks, everything, rice and beans tripled. The price of rice and beans tripled down there. So I definitely will remember, you know, being on second base when I heard that this disastrous thing has occurred.
Yeah, not many people can claim that they were standing on second base at the time.
Yeah.
And then Uncle Sam would get his hands on you. What did it mean to you when you were drafted and you realized that you're going to have to put baseball on hold and go serve?
Yeah, I did. I had just left Mexico, you know, of MVP down there. But I knew that, you know, you had to go. I had a daughter who was only 6 months old. I didn't want to leave her and my wife. But, you know, Uncle Sam called. And we had to go. I was drafted, spent my training in Fort Belvoir, Virginia, and after about 6 weeks, went on down to Camp Claiborne, Louisiana. And then in a few months, we caught a troop ship going to England. It was in the North Atlantic for 19 days, and the North Atlantic can be rough, even in the summertime, but in the wintertime, it's almost impossible. And so in 19 days, we were on that ship in a convoy of 500 ships. And guess what? We didn't lose one ship out of a convoy of 500. But when we got to Liverpool, we couldn't stand up because of that rocking and roll. Yeah, it was a funny thing.
That would do it to you. And much like baseball was segregated at the time, the military was segregated at this time. And
yeah,
so you were in
tragic.
The 1313th Engineer General Service Regiment?
Yes, uh-huh.
With all African-American soldiers?
Yeah, uh-huh. At the beginning, we had a white officer. Later on, he was replaced by an African-American CO, and then we got two or three other lieutenants. You know, we felt, you know, more comfortable, and it was treated a little better. So during, in 1944, after they invaded, June 6, 1944, was D-Day, but we didn't get there until 2 months later. And when we got there, Omaha Beach had been cleaned up. After staying around the beach for a while, we moved across Paris and settled on the other side. And then mainly our duty then became guard duty. A lot of the Nazi soldiers had surrendered, and there was a problem because there were so many of them. We had it was a chore trying to keep track of all of them. So that's what we mainly did until the war was over in Japan.
Now, I did read that your unit, during the Battle of the Bulge, that your unit was assigned not necessarily on the front line, but in reserve and near Reims, France.
That's true.
In the Meuse line and ready to blow up bridges if the order came?
Yeah. We blow up bridges and doing a lot of guard duty of refineries. Of course, we knew that the Nazis, needed fuel. A whole outfit was guarding the fuel depots, and luckily they stopped them, up at the Battle of the Bulge, and they never did get to Reims. But Reims was only about 60, 70 miles away, and if they had broken through, there was going to be some heavy fighting in and around Reims, France. We were so happy that it didn't happen.
Now, I've read before, and I've interviewed several African-American veterans from World War II who told me about how they were treated overseas and then how they were treated back in the States. Did you notice a difference, and did that time overseas give you a new perspective?
Yes, it did. We were treated better by the natives, by the English and the French and then people from Belgium. We had a lot of problems with our own soldiers, mainly, and why they wanted to, be so anti, we just couldn't understand it. And then after we came back here, back to the States, we were scorned also, and we couldn't understand why. We were called on to do a job, and we did it, but seemingly nobody appreciated enough, to welcome us back home.
Well, I'm sure on cold nights in France, in a foxhole, you probably weren't thinking, I'm going to be a baseball Hall of Famer someday.
No, not at all. In fact, before it went over, I never thought that we'd ever get the chance to, play in the majors. But after going, seeing how things were done over there and so on, some of the guys was very happy that they experienced a lot of freedom. And when we came back, the saying was, if they can fight for the country, why can't we play for them? So there was a move afoot to get us into Major League. I remember Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia had a group, and he was, along with Adam Clayton Powell and some other politicians, had that in their minds to do it. But then Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson, so that
Hold on there, because the way I heard it, Branch Rickey wanted to sign you.
He did, and I signed with him. I told him I'd had a hard time, didn't have a chance to play at all over there. I said, I'll sign with you, but I'll let you know when I'm ready. He said, well, that's great.
And you had some ringing in your ears from all the artillery overseas?
Yeah, I had an inner ear problem. And 2 years, it got better. And then I started to play like I had been playing. And selecting Jackie, they picked a college-educated person who had gained publicity and notoriety out there at the UCLA. He starred in four sports. He was wasn't the best player, but he was the most adequate person that Branch Rickey could have taken. And then, lo and behold, Jackie improved every year. He became a clutch hitter. He became a real good second baseman. He became very thrilling on the bases. So it shows you that, how, I guess, smart that Branch Rickey was by picking Jackie. And we're all grateful and very happy that he did such a great job of pioneering.
Oh, and it sounds like one of the reasons you said wait on me is you felt if you were the first one and you weren't 100% that you wouldn't have represented your whole league and whole race of people.
Yeah, yeah.
So it worked out just the way it should have.
Worked out just fine. Jackie did a great job. You know, he passed away in 1972. Can't believe that he's been gone that long. But he did one super job. Had to take a lot, but he did. We're, again, very grateful for the wonderful job that he did.
The late, great Monty Irvin. You can listen to his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we're not done yet. When this special episode of Hometown Heroes continues, another veteran who continued blazing trails long after his World War II service. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.